Hello, everyone, and welcome to Risky Business. I'm Patrick Gray. And that's right, we're starting off with a bit of copyright infringement this week, but I think under the circumstances, the music police might allow it, not fine me $2.6 million, because after all, I'm not a single mother. Come on, man, it's a tribute. It's a tribute, man. Poor Jacko, that guy's life was one big tragedy, wasn't it? World's greatest pop sensation, world's worst babysitter. Not that I actually think he did anything, but I wouldn't let kids I know hang out with a dude who models his persona on Peter Pan, would you? But yeah, poor guy, poor kids as well. There we go, death of an icon, moving on. And this week's edition of the show is hosted by Vigabyte and brought to you by Microsoft, makers of Big Serious Intertubes software. And this week we're taking a look at the technology angle to this whole mess in Iran. We'll be chatting with Arbor Network's chief scientist, Craig Labovitz, about the filtering they're doing over there. That's the Iranian government, not Arbor. And then we'll be checking in with Rolof Temming of Perturva. Now, Perturva makes Multigo, an open-source intelligence tool, an information correlation tool that many people are using out there to analyze various aspects of information flow in Iran, including the spread of propaganda via Twitter bots. Now, this stuff is really cool, and that's coming up a bit later. We'll also be hearing from Microsoft's Stuart Strathdy in this week's sponsor interview. He'll be joining us to discuss a few aspects of Morrow, the software that probably had more antitrust lawyers involved in its development than actual developers. But before we get into all of that, however, I should mention that we've added a whole bunch of fresh content to RB2, or Risky Business 2, which is the second podcast on our website at risky.biz. We've brought on a new reporter who's working for us on a sort of freelance casual basis, who's Paul Craig, and he'll be doing semi-regular interviews for us, which is great. It's taken a while to find someone right for that job, but Paul's definitely it. And this week on RB2, you'll hear Luke McCormie's keynote speech from the ShakaCon HackerCon in Hawaii, which is all about corporate espionage. And you'll also hear an interview Paul did with Luke, and also a sponsor interview I did with Symantec's Vincent Weifer. Symantec has sponsored Risky Business 2 and really helped to get it off the ground, so big thanks to those guys. Anyway, on with the show now, and it's time to check the week's news headlines with Risky Business news analyst, hacker, and all-round nice guy, Adam Metalstorm Boileau. And Adam, it looks like the team at Finjan are now offering yet another browser plugin designed to make end users more secure, and this time it is a Twitter browser plugin designed to stop Twitter users from clicking on dodgy links.
Now, this does seem a bit silly. I mean, well, what are we going to end up with? You know, things that stop you from clicking your mouse in bad places. And yeah, it's kind of like we're fracturing the security products market so much here that, it just seems a little over the top to me.
Well, I think it was Peter Gutman who I think said it's just a matter of time if we keep going like this before computers start getting reissued with squishy rubber keyboards that you can't hurt yourself on and mice with special cords that you can't choke yourself on.
Yeah, although actually a keyboard that would survive having coffee poured in it is probably a useful thing.
True.
For Twitter users and otherwise. But no, I agree. I think this seems a bit silly, you know, and really, is this a social problem or a technological problem? You know, people clicking on dumb links and looking at funnycats.exe. There's only so much you can do in software about that.
It's a picnic problem. Problem in chair, not in computer.
Yeah, it's one of those, I think.
One of those. Look, decent PR strategy, I think. I would suspect that's probably more why these guys have done it.
Yeah, I expect so, yeah. So, well, we're talking about them, so they won, right?
Yeah, that's it. Damn it, I should edit this out. All right, now, in this next piece, this one's a pretty damn interesting piece, which is there is a exploit for the SensorWare. This story comes to us via CNET. There's a exploit for a flaw in the SensorWare mandated by the Chinese government. There's O-Day code for this bug, and it's out there. It's a buffer overflow.
Yeah, so this is pretty interesting, eh? Like, so the Chinese government mandate that the software Green Dam, which is some kind of, you know, spyware, sensorware sort of thing, is pre-installed on all PCs sold in the country from the beginning of next month. Mm. And yeah, there's already exploits in the wild for it, and that's a pretty big deal, I think, eh? Like, I mean, if we're going to deploy this thing on 100 million machines potentially, or, you know, I don't know how many machines there are in China, how many they sell, but that's a lot of machines to be able to own in one go. you know, the software monoculture is a bad thing, eh? And this is a good example of where it's really going to bite you.
Well, it seems like a really strange idea to mandate that you need to install all of this software on the client, because it seems kind of unenforceable unless, I mean, I guess there'd be some sort of knack element to it where it would drop you if you don't have it running or something, but it just seems like really dumb policy, to be honest.
Well, I mean, from the point of view of the knack side of things, right, until we have trusted hardware and TPM remote attestation stuff like that, there is basically no way you can assure that the systems are running this stuff. So yeah, it's a basically a flawed architecture in the first place. But if you mandate that people have to have it installed, and there's, you know, and we can exploit it, then, well, you know, that's bad for everybody. I don't see how that works out well, even for the government.
How does the exploit actually work? I mean, is this something where you can hit an open port? I mean, I'd assume not. I'd assume that you would need some sort of client interaction with this thing.
The article actually says that the guy who released the exploit says he wrote a Metasploit exploit module for Internet Explorer, which exploits the stack-based buffer overflow on IE6.
Nice.
And IE7.
Nice.
So, yeah, basically it's exploiting it via the browser. There's a DLL that intercepts internet traffic, apparently, that has uses fixed length buffers. So, you know, like pretty bog standard sort of stuff.
If you can hit it through the browser, I mean, that's gold.
Yeah, well, the guy's written the Metasploit plugin, so, you know, we can all point and click our way through that, right?
Yeah, then again, I mean, you've got to imagine that most computers in China would probably be vulnerable to about 6 billion different IE exploits anyway, so I don't know.
Yeah, and all the crazy instant messaging exploits and, yeah, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so I don't know. Sounds cool, but, yeah, I mean, why bother owning this stuff when you can just own them through IE? Because, you know, it's harder getting the patches when you're not registered and there's a lot of fake software over there and yada, yada, yada. But
yeah.
This next piece, Adam, I find quite interesting because it's a statement of the bloody bleedingly obvious from 5 years ago, which is Great Britain has acknowledged that it is actually setting up a red team. I mean, stop presses. You mean governments actually have hackers to do offensive work? I mean, that's mind-blowing. They've only been buying exploits off researchers for like the last forever.
Please say it ain't so. What, they employ hackers? Damn.
Yeah, to hack, no less. So according to Wired News, Great Britain has launched this new cybersecurity command center to help combat network intruders and forge offensive attacks against opponents. What do you think of all of this?
Well, I mean, I think it's good that they're actually acknowledging it publicly that, yes, this is what they need to do. And I suppose it's good in the sense that, you know, governments, militaries do need to have this kind of capacity from a defense point of view. But on the other hand, I don't know whether taking all these people and sticking them into government environments is necessarily going to produce the same results as leaving them out in the open. You know, all the secrecy and the closed environments of government circles. I don't think that's really good for research and the research community. So it's a bit double-edged, I think. Taking it into that environment may reduce some of the benefits that they would otherwise get.
But do we know that they are actually making them all wear, you know, iron shirts and sit in cubicles? Or is it just more of a, you know, organizational thing, not necessarily a you must work in this building and only do this sort of thing?
Yeah, well, I think governments are governments. They can't stop doing that stuff, even if they wanted to.
Moving on now, and this one is hilarious because, you know what, we're nearly getting to the point where we can pack our bags and we can go home and we don't have to worry about this information security thing anymore because DNSSEC, according to Dark Reading, is showing some signs of progress.
Well, and this is pretty amazing stuff. Who would have thought that DNSSEC would overtake IPv6?
That's
in the list of silver bullets, you know?
It's like a snail race.
Yeah, backwards, maybe, yeah. But no, it's amazing that some of the vendors are actually talking about DNSSEC and the media are covering it and stuff. I think the thing that's going to make a difference, and like what they're really talking about in this article, is that the US government are starting to mandate the use of it in government domains, and that will push the vendors to support it well. And once the vendors support it well, then you know, commercial entities will start using it as well, I think, just, you know, as they start upgrading their DNS servers and DNS appliances and things. So I think, you know, follow on in, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 years, maybe we'll actually see people using DNSSEC in a more widespread sort of manner.
Now, what does DNSSEC actually do? I mean, it basically gives you some confidence that the IP address that you're being told is the correct IP address, doesn't it?
Well, basically it allows you to assign DNS records so that you end up having kind of PKI integrated with your DNS. So you can assume the DNS records you're seeing are not spoofed or lies or cache poisoned or whatever.
Yeah, this doesn't really help us when it comes to things like, I mean, everyone was okay, wow, Dan Kaminsky's bug is really serious and you can man in the middle people with it and blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, some guys come out a little time after that with a BGP bug that basically lets you do the same thing, only you can't really patch it. And you've done a whole bunch of work yourself that I've seen you present on carrier grade Ethernet, which allows you to do all sorts of really nasty man-in-the-middle stuff. And DNSSEC ain't going to do bubkiss to stop those sort of attacks, are they?
Well, no. I mean, any attack where you can get into the middle of a communication is going to allow you to do powerful things when there aren't cryptographic primitives further up the stack. And DNS is one example of that. BGP is another, all sorts of layer 2 trickery there. They're all tools to get you into the middle of the communication. And then once you're there, there's a whole bunch of other attacks you can do. And this is, I mean, part of this whole layered defense thing, right? We still use HTTPS in a world where we have DNSSEC. Because of the, you know, other ways of getting into the middle of the traffic communication. So, you know, we need PKI kind of all the way up and down the stack. You know, we need that at IP layer with IPsec, and we need it with DNS, and we need it with HTTPS application layer. So, yeah, it's we have to layer these things to make it work. And yeah, doing it in one place is great, but as you say, it doesn't solve all the problems. But I do think widespread adoption of DNSSEC would help with a bunch of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, I sort of look at this and I go, well, you know, it's not going to make a huge difference, but at least it's something, you know?
Well, we're making, you know, it is kind of progress, I guess. And, you know, maybe one day we'll see, you know, IPv6 and IP6 with opportunistic encryption everywhere and DNSSEC and everyone using HTTPS and a whole PKI world of goodness.
And we'll all be dancing through heavily encrypted meadows with smelling flowers and looking at pretty little bunnies.
Yeah, and bashing our heads into it every time it doesn't work.
Yeah, yeah. Every time it comes crumbling down. And, yeah, you get that whole picnic problem again. Anyway, moving on. Look, final story today, and this is more of a feature story that a friend of mine sent me that was written by that appeared on LAWeekly.com. And if you do a Google News search for Russian Armenian model employee, you should find it. It's a very interesting case study about how a guy basically got himself a job at an extremely high turnover gas station in the United States and used his position there to just steal thousands upon thousands upon thousands of credit card numbers. And then one day he just sort of disappeared along with 1,500 packs of cigarettes, $1,000 in cash, a laptop, his employee application form, and the digital video recorders that were used for surveillance.
Yeah, so I think this is a very good example of you know, organized crime and you know, real actual crime that's technology assisted rather than moving into the online world. And yeah, it's a classic malicious insider attack. You know, someone gets planted there for a reasonable amount of time, becomes trusted, and then walks out with your data. And in this case, yeah, like more than 1,000 people's worth of credit card data. And it looks like they got something about $300,000.
Well, they went between $300 and $500 was the average amount. So yeah, it could be that. It's hard to tell really from the way they've written it up. But either way, it would have been a tidy little score. What I find interesting too is it's quite obvious that this was a Magstripe scam, not necessarily a credit card scam. It really does look like they were after the Magstripe data, because they're talking about how bank accounts had been drained with a series of withdrawals, which suggests to me that they had PIN and Stripe.
Yeah, so they if the guy was maybe had a camera mounted over the pin pad or something, as well as the contents of the mags.
He could just plug his own pin pad in, man. I mean, you know, he's working there.
Well, exactly. Yeah. There's plenty of options around there, but no, I think it's a pretty interesting scam. And I suppose the thing that we take away from this, other than the fact that malicious insider attacks are real, is that in the end, according to the article, all the victims have had their money reimbursed by their banks. And so, yeah, we have to look at this and say, well, who's wearing the cost of fraud? Well, it's the banks. And where's the incentive to fix this problem going to be? With the banks. Like, as actual, and at the gas station, where's their incentive to fix this? There isn't any, you know? They don't wear any of the cost.
That's a little bit different because, you know, in this case, the fraud was done at the station, but the money was actually drained out of the account separately, so it would have been the bank. But if people had been using stolen cards at that gas station, it would have been the gas station that was liable. So the whole liability chain for this stuff is a real problem. But, I mean, I think it's kind of good to see the banks given a bit of a spanking and directly impacted by this stuff, because it means they're much more likely, banks in the United States and certainly here in Australia, will be much more likely to roll out stuff like EMV and really accelerate their chip and pin programs as they get hurt more. We've seen some incredible action here in Australia lately, we've had Romanian gangs turning up and just doing absolutely crazy amounts of skimming here in Australia. So I really think that'll accelerate the rollout into chip and pin countrywide, which I think can only be a good thing.
Yeah, well, I think it probably is a good thing. I know we had people installing skimmers on the front of ATM machines over here in New Zealand a year or two ago, and that the banks, rather than rolling anything fancy, they just stuck plastic sleeves on the front of all the ATMs.
You have ATMs in New Zealand?
Yeah. We have the sheep. They have, like, slots in them and stuff, and that's pretty sweet.
Where do you get the electricity to actually power them?
Static.
Nice. All right, Adam, that actually takes us to the end of the news. Thank you, as always, for joining us here on Risky Business, and we'll chat to you next week.
Thanks very much, man. See you.
Adam Boileau on the line from New Zealand there with a look at the last week's news headlines. Just to update you now on a few events, there'll be an e-crime symposium. It's like a one-day conference in Sydney on the 4th of August. If you work in a fraud-prone industry, you should definitely look at attending. It's, as I said, it's on August 4, and you can find the details at ecrimesymposium.com. There's also a couple of ACER events coming up. There's a Perth branch meeting on Tuesday the 14th of July, a members' lunch on the 9th of July in Sydney, and there's also a branch meeting in Sydney on the 15th of July. More information at acer.org.au. That's AISA.org.au. Next up, it's time to turn our attention to Iran, where, as you know, there's been a series of protests over the election result there. People are none too thrilled about Mr. Crazy Pants getting himself back into government. Now, the government in Iran has started blocking services like SSH, Flash Video, and BitTorrent and so on. So for a more detailed look at the internet censorship that's going on over there, I got on the line with Arbor Network's chief scientist, Craig Labovitz. Now, Craig is involved with the Internet Observatory, which consists of essentially cooperation between 110 Tier 1 and Tier 2 providers that started off as a way for those members to, or those providers to help block big DDoS attacks, but now looks at general ops issues. Between all of them, they've got the ability to analyze the world's traffic and certainly have found some very interesting things when it comes to what's happening post-election in Iran.
Well, we looked at what was going into Iran and what was going out of Iran both before and after the election and compared sort of the percentages. And what they're blocking is down across the board, traffic is down anywhere from 30 to 40% from normal levels before the election. But in particular, they're not blocking things proportionally. Not all applications are down by the same amount proportionally. What they're blocking is things like SSH is blocked almost across the board, followed by video, followed by FTP and web traffic and so on.
Yeah, now SSH struck me as being an unusual thing to block. Are they blocking that by port or by protocol?
You know, we don't know. There's lots of rumors and lots of speculation. The speculation, including folks that claim they've got, discussions with inside technical insight, is that they had some basic mail and web filtering capability prior to the election, and they were doing some degree of IP address and URL blocking prior to the election. After the election, put in place more payload or content inspection and blocking things both by port and now by payload as well. Well, just within the technical community, the easiest way to get around filters is just by setting up an SSH tunnel. It's the most secure, and it's the easiest way, and hundreds of applications support sort of native SSH proxy or SSH tunnel support. So while the average home user might not know how to use SSH, and certainly blocking web or port 80 may be more than sufficient for the average user, SSH is the protocol of choice. It's what I use. Not that I'm getting around, firewalls around my political speech, but when I travel or when I'm in other settings, I always use SSH to tunnel back or my VPN traffic.
How effective is this sort of filtering?
Well, I don't think their goal is to block all traffic. I think that if they wanted to block all traffic, they could. There's not that many entry points. All the entry points are state-controlled, including satellite, into Iran. So the issue isn't can they block it all. I think they could just turn off everything, as Burma did in the past or other countries. What they've done, rather, is just make it incredibly inconvenient for the average user to get around the firewall. But still, I think the point is accomplished, which for the vast majority, you keep internet access available while meeting your political, social, whatever your goal is.
Now, you've got some very interesting graphs on this blog post that you've written for the Arbor Network's blog. Things like looking at the amount of flash video going in and coming out of Iran. Is that right?
That's right. You'll notice that we have some before and after graphs that show the traffic going up to the election and traffic going after. Some protocols were very dramatically impacted. One of these, of course, as you just noted, is indeed flash. It's probably one of the more dramatic drop-offs. Other protocols slowly rise up after the election, but flash remains fairly significantly impacted throughout and continues to this day.
So by the looks of your analysis, the top blocked applications in Iran are SSH, then flash, then BitTorrent, Popmail, alternative web ports, HTTP proxy, which I think would be a fairly obvious one, webcams, SMB, which I think is kind of funny. I think they're probably doing people a favor by blocking that stuff going over the net. You've also got web, mail, and FTP. Any surprises there?
No, I was amused to see SSH. I don't know if amused is the right word, but I was struck to see SSH almost completely blocked. I think the only other observation would be that they clearly are blocking web and mail, but what we really are looking at in the graph is before and after. So I think the belief is that before the election, they already had significant web and mail filtering in place. So the drop off isn't quite as dramatic. But clearly someone decided all SSH was bad after the election, and they're blocking the vast majority of it.
Have they dropped Twitter yet?
Twitter. We weren't looking at Twitter in particular, and in general, our visibility really is into bandwidth. So very low bandwidth applications like Twitter really won't show up as well compared to large video and other applications. And in general, we're not talking about massive amounts of traffic. You know, Iran in general has anywhere from, average of 6 gigabits before the election at any given time going into the country, which compares with, say, a small provider in a mid-sized U.S. state. It's not the most bandwidth-heavy country in the world.
Arbor Network's chief scientist, Craig Labovitz there. Well, there's some other interesting little angles to this story as far as technology goes. For one, Twitter has been lauded by Western geeks as some kind of substitute to the traditional foreign media, which has been kicked out of the country. I mean, the US State Department, I think it was the State Department, could have been some other arm of government, even asked Twitter, formally requested that they delay some scheduled downtime so as not to interrupt the service's use by protesters as a means to organize themselves. Now, what's interesting here is that many of the tweets that we're seeing on the Iran issue appear to actually be machine generated and machine spread. So that's right, tweet bots spreading propaganda, mostly pro-Iran propaganda. And here it is, I'm going to coin the new word, and I hope this one takes off, Twittergander. Put that in your pipe and smoke it. Let's hope that one catches on. Now, Twitter.com has been blocked in Iran, but through the magic of the Twitter API, it seems messages are still able to get in and out of the system, in and out of the country into that system. Anyway, several people have been examining the information flying back and forth on Twitter using Multigo. So Rulof Temming, who actually created the Multigo software, it's an open source intelligence, it's open source intelligence analysis software. So what it does is it's an information visualization tool that you can use to make little networked diagrams of links between information. And that could be anything from servers on the internet to links between Twitter users or what they're talking about, which is in this instance. Now, who better to ask about his analysis of the Twitter thing than the guy who actually created Multigo, because that's what a few people have been using and then blogging about. So we got Rulof on the line to ask him about his analysis. Now, before we cut to this interview, I'll warn you in advance that the first couple of minutes, there was a little click about every second for about the first minute and a half, which we figured out was actually being caused by Roelof's electric fence. So he turned that off for a little bit, and we actually got the interview done. So it only is present in the first minute and a half, but it's frighteningly annoying. But I didn't want to cut that content, so just try to bear with it. But here he is now, Roelof Temming, discussing his analysis of Twitter propaganda in Iran.
Well, I found something that was quite interesting. If you look on Twit spam, you'll see that they list a whole lot of the identities that are that are associated with suspected disinformation. So I pulled a couple of those in, and I started looking at those and see who those people are speaking to and those kind of thing. And a lot of this stuff seems to be automated. So you can even see it in the kind of user agent that gets propagated through to the Twitter website, that they're using the Perl API library for Twitter. So what was interesting is that not a lot of people are retweeting the stuff that was said by these automated bots, except for a group of people that seemed to pick up on it. And then I started looking at this group, and it turned out that was another bot.
So you've got bots following bots.
Yeah, it's quite funny. These guys were kind of also doing advertising and that kind of thing, and it seems like they're picking up on trending topics and then retweeting that. So they get to retweet some of the propaganda bots, which means you got bots following bots, and it's a strange kind of situation. You can see that they've got about 12 or 15 different kind of lines that they have. Like their subjects, their tweets, if that's the correct word. And they just kind of randomize them, and some of them are like...
Just sort of cycle between them, do they?
No, black ops in Iran, stop killing Iranian people.
So it is really interesting, isn't it, using something, using an information visualization tool to go over something like Twitter, because it becomes pretty quickly apparent when doing this sort of analysis who's real and who's not, doesn't it?
You can absolutely, you can see, in the graph that I have of the two bots basically following each other, they have a limited set of, call it vocabulary, and that basically gives them a very trackable kind of color that you can go after. You can basically see that they say the same kind of things over and over again, and those then correlate into the same areas. So the topics of those tweets would all be the same, or the actual sentences, which means you'll see them really quickly build up if you look at it on an edge-weighted view. And clearly then they're basically saying the same thing over and over again. Different people, though, saying it. But it's the same message.
So do you think that they could actually alter the intelligence, the AI behind these bots, and make them a lot more difficult to spot? Because it sounds like they're not being particularly smart about the way that they're using Twitter to push their propaganda.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, if you compare the Iranian propaganda bots to these bots, you can immediately see the intelligence of the advertising bots, of botnet, if you want to call it that, is a lot better than the propaganda bots.
So the Iranian government is no match for the will of the American marketer.
Well, I wouldn't say that, but when it comes to Twitter at the moment and the way that it looks now, it appears that way for sure.
And how much effort do you reckon they're actually putting into this? Is this something that, an arm of government would be doing? Is this probably a small team within the government? I mean, how much effort, how much of Iranians' taxpayer funds are being used to run this campaign, do you think?
Well, I mean, as a start, you're assuming that it is done by the government and not people that's just pro-Iran.
Mm.
So, I mean, it looks to me like it's just, maybe just one person doing this. It's not, it doesn't look that advanced. So I don't think it is government sanctioned at all.
You think the government would do a better job, do you?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what capabilities they have, but you could probably do a better job if you you put your mind to it for a while. It's not that you know, it's not that impressive. The other thing that I saw that was interesting also, you see a lot of this stuff now on Twitter spam, that a lot of the people are fake retweeting. Because it's just the thing that says RT, right? So so you could be saying that you are sending something along from someone else when it's actually not the case.
Yeah, so someone could go RT at Risky Business. I am a silly man with bad pants and bad hair.
Yeah, and because it's...
That's not very nice.
Because it's just text and there's no verification really on that. You find that a lot of the people are actually doing that now, and faking responses and faking, you know, forwards. And at the moment, let me tell you, I had a look at it for a couple of hours today, and it's really hard to find out what's really going on. And now what's happening is there's a lot of paranoia kicking in. So, you know, there was this one guy that's on a list of suspected disinformation or government agents. And he's basically publishing a list of proxies, right? It's probably open proxies, but it's a lot. I mean, it's probably like, what, 60, 70 IP addresses with ports. And I had a quick look at it, and, you know, those IP addresses are fairly distributed across the internet.
And what? So they're trying to suggest that perhaps they're monitoring those proxies.
Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, just to monitor those proxies in terms of how far they are apart and different networks that they're on would be pretty impressive. So, you know, and I don't think he's actually, you know, I don't think he's monitoring any of it. But there's lots of paranoia now on who's real and who's not real. And, you know, don't speak to anyone that whose name starts with this. And, you know, it's all a little bit silly. Well, I'm sitting here. It's not me that's, you know, in the middle of this crisis.
Silly for us. Silly for us. Not so silly for the Iranians, the poor buggers.
No, for sure. So I think the other question that you need to ask yourself is, you know, how much of the support that's been rallied up and people changing their icons to be green and that kind of thing, you know, how much of that is really making a difference? I saw one of the guys speaking on this saying that, you know, only 1% of Iranians can speak English. But all of these tweets that's floating around are in English. So you got to ask yourself, you know, what's really going on there?
Rolof Temming on the line from South Africa there. And I've got to say, every time I hear a South African accent, for some reason, I always have flashbacks to hearing the 12th man's impersonation of Tony Greig doing a pitch report at the cricket.
Dug deep, the curator here and his ground staff have done a marvellous job again. There's quite a bit of green, as you can see, on top of the surface. That, of course, will brown off pretty quickly over the next few days.
Maybe it's just me. I don't know. But it's marvellous. Now, if you enjoyed that interview, you might also like to read a piece Rulof has written for Risky.biz about social networks. So head over to the site now and read it, or do something completely crazy. I mean, just lose your mind and post a comment, because that would be kind of cool. Haven't had many comments over the last week or so. But anyway, it's time now for this week's sponsor interview, and we're chatting with Stuart Strathdy from Microsoft Australia about the company's release, beta release anyway, of its Morro antivirus package. Morro is free software made for consumers, and one of the reasons it's been released is to help stem the trade in fake antivirus software. You know the stuff, it's basically a malware and spyware package dressed up as an AV solution. So people wind up paying $50 to get infected. It's a little bit nuts. So I got Stuart on the line to get the skinny on Morro, and I should warn you that we've had flooding around my area lately, and it's made the phone line muy buzzy, senor, but please bear with it.
So what we've got is the beta now has just been released. And it's essentially the US English version. It's available for Windows XP, Windows Vista, and also for Windows 7. in both 32 and 64-bit editions.
But it will still spell words that end with Z-E incorrectly, right? With S-E. So it'll say organise with a Z. And...
Yeah, so we are only in the beta phase. We haven't done a lot of localisation and that sort of thing at the moment. I believe that what we've got is versions that are available in US English. And also, I think Portuguese is out with simplified Chinese coming in the next few months.
Wow, I didn't spot Portuguese as being the big number two, but there you go. So when's the actual official version coming out?
We haven't got the final release date as yet, so sometime later this year.
So you guys are like a coiled spring. You could be releasing this at any point.
look, I know there is a lot of localization work still to be done. So from what I understand, the beta has been a staggered release, and I think it's probably likely that we may see the final product work in a similar manner. But, you know, a lot of focus has been made on trying to make it as user-friendly as possible. So it's just going to take us a little bit of time to achieve that.
Maybe you guys could be like Google and just leave it as a beta for the next 10 years.
We'd rather not.
Now, look, one of the reasons that this software has actually been rolled out to consumers free of charge is because of this hideous rogue antivirus software. Tell us about this badware.
Okay, so, you know, there's a good and a bad side to this problem. The good side is that consumers are out there actively trying to protect their machines, and they are looking for antivirus, anti-malware products, preferably free, as we've seen, to try to protect themselves. The bad side of this is that, unfortunately, there's a number of sort of drive-by downloads and email exploits and that sort of thing where what's happening is it's installing this rogue security software, and then the rogue security software pops up with false alerts, you know, offering to fix problems that don't actually exist. And then when you say yes, sometimes what it'll do is it'll take you off to their website and ask you to pay, you know, $50 or $60 to upgrade to the latest versions. Other times, it just goes looking for things like, you know, credit card details and user names and passwords, that sort of thing.
So this is like the quintessential dodgy mechanic for your computer. You go in there with like a clogged fuel filter or something, and all of a sudden they're telling you you've got to change your timing belts, you know, you need to have your engine reboard, that sort of thing. It's going to cost you $5,000, that sort of thing.
Exactly. So, and the problem is that, you know, people really are trying to do the right thing, which is, you know, what we, and I say we, meaning us as the sort of IT security industry, have been encouraging them to do. But I think the clearest message that comes out of all of this is, you know, the problem with spam and the problem with malicious applications of any sort, it's a matter of trust. Do you know the people that you know you're downloading their software and installing it? Are they a reputable business? And so it really comes down to, you know, there are some big providers out there, Microsoft just being one of those.
Stuart, this is what leads me to my next question, which is that, you know, I can see the appeal now in providing an official source of antivirus. So it's a great idea to have an official source from Microsoft of antivirus, but do you not worry that by doing that, you're actually going to sort of distort the market a little bit for some of the other AV players in there?
So I suppose what you'll always see, or, you know, from my personal experience anyway, when new products come to market, they normally have somewhat of a local adoption as they build their brand and they build their reputation. And then what will often happen is they might be reviewed by another reputable website, or you know, they might be adopted by one or two big companies that, you know, have a lot of employees, so their employees might start picking it up. So I think what you're going to find is that obviously for the existing players that are out there, they will, you know, they'll be the names that most people sort of know and trust. But for new players, they'll just have to go through a more typical sort of growth pattern that any normal sort of you know, non-internet business would go through. And, you know, it's about building a brand name and about building a reputation.
So has there been a critical reaction at all from some of the antivirus companies?
Yeah, definitely.
So they've seen what happens when, you know, because Microsoft, when it moves into a sort of market niche, can tend to exhibit, deliberately or not, characteristics resembling those of the Borg collective. You do know this.
Yeah, so I suppose, Patrick, my comment would be, you know, how could we not move into this space? I mean, yeah. Microsoft has had to do this. I think it was a no-brainer. Because what we're seeing is, you know, the rise of the netbook. We're also seeing many, many third world countries, you know, start to come online in incredible numbers. And also, you know, a lot of countries, particularly up through areas like Southeast Asia, that haven't had deep PC penetration into some of their markets. We're now seeing that change very, very rapidly.
So I guess what you're saying is people won't necessarily pay or can't necessarily justify paying for antivirus on their netbook, and people in the third world basically can't afford it.
That's right. So, you know, we've got to try and secure the entire environment. So if we're going to encourage online commerce and trade, then it really is about trying to make that entire environment as secure as possible. And as you said, some people just absolutely can't afford to pay for it. And then there are other people that purely just don't want to pay for it and will go miscellaneously downloading sort of any security titled product. And so we're now trying to provide them with an alternative that's from a reputable organisation.
It is one of those things for Microsoft, isn't it, where in this instance, you're pretty much damned if you do and you're pretty much damned if you don't.
Exactly. It's a catch-22. But either way, I think the way that we're approaching it and the way that we're, you know, releasing the betas, we've done a lot of testing, we're very much focusing it on the consumer market. I think there's been no secret that Microsoft's moving into this area. Mm. It's certainly been public and it's been coming for a long time. And we've also had a toe in the water with the OneCare product. So yeah. People sort of know what we're about, know what direction we're taking. So for any of the other AV vendors, this is really no surprise whatsoever.
I wonder with a project like this, who there were more of during the development, which is actual people who write software or antitrust lawyers. But that's perhaps a topic for another day. Stuart Strathdy, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business, as always.
Thanks, Patrick.
Strange. I've seen that face before.
Microsoft's Stuart Strathdy there in this week's sponsor interview. And that's it for this week. This week's Sound Foundation track is the Grace Jones song Libertango, as performed by Glass. And I've played this one a few times because I really like it. You can buy this track as a plain old MP3, no DRM, from soundfoundation.com.au. Until next week, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening to the show.
Shadows me back home. Footsteps echo on the stone. The rainy nights, the hustling boulevards, and the music drifting from the bars. Drags, bars and restaurants, all with anyone who wants. Strange, I see you sitting. face before.